my name is Religious Studies Project. You killed my father. Prepare to die.
I don't even know what that was, but I liked it.
It's Princess Bride, man.
I've never seen it.
It's one of those films that when you hear the title, Princess Bride, you think, nah, I'm not going to watch that. I actually had it confused with The Princess Diaries for a while, which I believe is quite a different film.
It is quite different, yeah. That's Anne Hathaway, I believe.
Yeah, so when I finally saw the Princess Bride, I was not disappointed. It's very...
I always assumed it was a sort of like Princess Street, whereas I thought it was Princess Street, but it's actually the Princess Street, but no, it is the Princess Bride.
Exactly. Yep. No, I thoroughly recommend watching it. There's a brilliant bit. There's a priest who constantly talks about Malian. I'm sure it'll be familiar to our listeners.
Our listeners who may at this point be wondering which podcast they've tuned into.
You've done this.
This is not the 1980s film project. This is the Religious Studies Project. I'm your host, David Robertson, and he's your host,
Christopher Cotter.
And we're here. Well, we never said where we were last week, did we? We're in the halfway house.
Which is one of the smallest pubs in Edinburgh. I don't know if it's quite the smallest, but...
It's getting on for it. It's also a highly respected camera pub. It's been Camera Pub of the Year on several occasions. To be frank, I think there's a reason why it's been a few years, judging by the beer today.
I've now moved on to your point of tenant.
Indeed. But it's a tiny little old house that's been here 300-400 years, halfway down a close off the historic Royal Mile.
Right beside the train station.
Very close to the train station, yeah.
If you ever come to visit us, we'll bring you there.
Indeed. You can step off the train, you can be in here in 10 minutes and drunk in 20.
Yeah.
That's the RSP promise.
RSP price promise. This week, provocative podcast for you. We've got Tommy Coleman talking with Robert McCauley on why religion is natural and science is not. And we'll maybe reflect on that after the interview. For now, take it away, Tommy.
This is Thomas Coleman for the Religious Studies Project, and today I'm speaking with Dr. Robert McCauley. He is a professor at Emory University and director of their Center for Mind, Brain, and Culture. He's considered one of the founders of cognitive science of religion field. Currently, Dr. McCauley has a book out titled Why Religion is Natural and Science is Not, which if you don't already have a copy of it, you can pick one up using a link to Amazon.com on the Religious Studies Project website, which helps the RSP earn a few very important pennies in the process as well. Dr. McCauley, thank you for joining us today. Can you, why is religion natural and science not?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me. It's always a lot of fun to talk about this project and the book. My proposal is sort of a new twist in the religion-science comparison industry, in that rather than sort of looking at the traditional concerns, either theological or metaphysical or epistemological, my interests are in the cognitive foundations of these two activities and to compare them in that regard. And I think that this is, in fact, an unprecedented comparison. My suggestion to kind of summarize the thesis of the entire book is that from a cognitive standpoint, religion can be said to be natural, to involve what I will call natural cognition in a far more intimate way and far more frequently than does science. I should stress right off that these are sort of these are comparative claims. It's not to say that there isn't anything natural about science. In fact, I'll argue that there are some things that are natural about science, but religion, and by this I mean popular religion, engages a host of mental dispositions that I think can, in some broad sense, be described as natural to the human mind. I use the distinction that's out there. It's been out there in experimental psychology really for 40 years at least, probably made most famous recently by Dan Kahneman's new book, Thinking Fast and Slow, to try to explicate this sense of cognitive naturalness that I have in mind. But I introduce a distinction of my own, and that is amongst those forms of fast thinking. But perhaps I should explicate the overall comparison first, that is to say, between thinking fast and slow. The suggestion is, in short, that there's at least two kinds of cognitive processing that, that human minds engage in. The slow thinking is probably what we most normally and commonsensically think of as thinking. That is to say, that mental life that we have that is very careful, reflective, conscious, that oftentimes, in fact, usually I suspect most of us at least feel like it's usually carried out in language, that we're, as it were, thinking in sentences of our own. Probably, you know, the form of thought that is, as it were, most familiar to us. Fast thinking, by comparison, is intuitive. It's indeed fast, not slow. It's intuitive, not reflective. It's mostly, pretty overwhelmingly, unconscious rather than conscious, but sort of online cognition, what's going on in our minds as we simply work our way through the world that we're in a variety of domains. We seem to have knowledge. We don't know how we got that knowledge, yet it is knowledge that comes to us as it were, instantaneously in a number of settings when we have the right kind of cues. And even though we're not very clear about exactly where we got the knowledge or even, as it were, to be able to fully articulate what lies beneath it, we typically have a great deal of confidence in it. To give an example, our ability to read people's emotions from their facial expressions or from their tones of voice or from their bodily postures. These are all things that humans are able to do, humans do, again, as I said, instantly. And yet it's not all that easy to articulate how it is we know those things. Probably as it were, the parade case for this is simply our knowledge of our natural languages. Right now I'm doing my best to formulate good, well-formed sentences.
You're doing a pretty good job, might I add.
Well, thank you. But this is not because there's any planning, a forethought. Language seems to just roll out of our mouths in ways that is semantically and syntactically and pragmatically constrained, and yet we typically don't spend a second thinking about any of those considerations. Moreover, we have a rich knowledge about our language, and that which is typically only transparent to us when somebody makes an error. That's an easy enough with foreign speakers, but with a native speaker, to use one of Noam Chomsky's favorite and famous examples, if I make the utterance "curious green ideas sleep furiously," we understand there's a problem with that utterance. Any native English speaker would. Mm-hmm. We understand that the problem is of a very particular sort. I mean, it would be rather different from, say, if I uttered something like "ideas sleep curious green furiously." That utterance has a different set of problems, but it's problematic as well. And I mean, this is the kind of knowledge, as it were, that seems intuitive and fast. Now, that said, in my own book, I want to distinguish between two forms of fast thinking. What I call maturational naturalness of cognition in contrast to the practiced naturalness of cognition. I'm going to actually start with the second first because in some ways it's the easier to talk about. That is to say, practiced naturalness. In short, in any area where human beings become experts, because they've had a lot of experience, a lot of practice, a lot of interaction, and sometimes a lot of instruction in some area or other, they begin to develop these kinds of fast intuitions that seem to have the traits that I just described. By expertise, I don't mean anything terribly fancy here. I mean, it's the case that there are people who are experts in esoteric fields, including science, for example, but say playing chess, for example. There's been a lot of research that's been done on chess experts, and so we know that they have perceptual and analytical abilities that far exceed any of us sort of mere mortals who try to undertake the game.
Certainly.
And for them, that's come from, as they say, 10,000 hours of practice.
And no one's born playing chess, certainly.
Exactly. No one's born playing chess. These are learned abilities. But as I said, I don't necessarily mean anything esoteric. If you travel to a new city and as a visitor, you want to use the public transportation system, you know instantly that you don't understand the system. You've got to find out, you know, first of all, what it costs, what forms of payment they'll take, how, in fact, your purchase is certified, whether you get a ticket or whether you have a card or whether or not you don't have any of those things and the turnstile simply opens, and so on. Whereas in any given city that has a system like this, there are tens of thousands of people who use it every day, and they do it quite literally unthinkingly. Because they've developed an expertise. When we have these kinds of abilities, we have an idiom in English that seems to me to be right on target with the thesis of my book, and that is we describe these kinds of abilities as becoming, as it were, second nature to us. But I want to stress now, after having explicated that that's not the stuff I'm most interested in. I'm interested in first nature, what I'm going to call maturationally natural capacities. And I would include a variety of abilities that humans have that seem to share a number of properties. These are things that are typically emerge pretty early in human development. There are things that don't require any instruction, any teaching, any special environments for their acquisition. Humans seem to be able to acquire these forms of knowledge across a vast array of different sorts of environments. These things, these capacities, virtually define what we take to be as normal human development. As a parent, if your child isn't manifesting these capacities on a fairly constrained developmental schedule, you know, you take your kid to the doctor. So I have in mind things like, and I should add that these are also capacities that we acquire before we ever remember that we've got them. I mean, when you think about practice naturalness, say like when you learn to ride a bicycle or when you learn to read and write, these are things you remember, and you can look back on them and you remember, for most of us, we remember when those occasions, you know, when that learning started. By contrast, we don't remember when we learn to talk or when we learn to walk. And we don't remember when we learn to be able to read facial expressions to ascertain people's emotional states. We basically have a whole wide range of capacities like these that take a while to emerge, some a little longer than others. But it's certainly the case that by the time that children reach roughly school age, say 5, 6, 7 years of age, somewhere in that ballpark, most of these capacities seem to be in place. And I'll just add, rather than trying to go through the details of it, that there's really now a fair amount of cross-cultural experimental research that shows that this is true across cultures. That is to say that the same kinds of knowledge are in place and that they seem to be in place at about the same times in life.
Mm-hmm.
I'll turn now to saying what all this has to do with science and religion.
If I could just interrupt you there, for the listeners, essentially, what is this popular religion that we'll be referring to? And also, you know, because certainly the notion or the definition of religion can certainly escape us, and I would also argue perhaps science as well. So perhaps if you could go into popular religion and what the notion of science is that we're comparing it to.
Well, sure. And indeed, in some ways, my comparison is might seem structured in a way that will sort of get the result that I want, but that's okay. I mean, in fact, I think this is the way that the comparison is typically carried out. And I think that it's the way in which we most regularly use the language of religion and the language of science. But by popular religion, what I mean is sort of religion that's out there and practiced and engaged in each and every day, the kind of religious cognition that routinely arises in human minds. I would stress that to the extent that I'm arguing that it's overwhelmingly grounded in maturationally natural cognition, I'm in effect downplaying the regards in which at least most of these popular forms are very richly engaged with what I would call reflective cognition, with the slow cognition. Now, that's not to say that there can't be slow cognition about religion. Of course there can be. There's all sorts of it. There's all sorts of reflection about religious ideas and religious thought and religious conduct. There are multiple forms of it. I carry out one form. I do the cognitive science of religion. But probably the best known form would be what we call theology, where that's a an activity that reflects directly on the contents of claims that arise out of popular religious systems.
So that's certainly not, you know, practicing theology would say is certainly not included in the notion of popular religion then.
Yeah, I think finally all of these things are probably to be situated on a continuum, mm-hmm. Actually a variety of continuum that I'll talk about, okay. Even probably the distinction between, you know, reflective, slow and fast thought. I mean, is there medium speed thought? Well, I'm trying to sort of, as it were, isolate those sorts of things that are characteristic of an awful lot of, I guess the word I'm prefer to use is recurrent forms of religious thought and practice that arise across, frankly, I think all religious systems. In contrast to that theological project, which is at least one step removed, to the extent that it involves a kind of looking at the claims, say, that are made in by religious people or in holy books, in sacred scriptures, where the theologian's trying to, as it were, sort of bring order to these materials of a, you know, logical principle sort. I should add also that, I mean, I think this distinction stands for other reasons in the domain of religion, and that is theology's not necessary for religion. In the world that you and I live in, and probably I suspect most of our listeners, it's a standard accoutrement, but there are plenty of situations in the course of the history of our species where there's been all sorts of religion without there being any theology, I would guess. I think the theology, and now maybe this is as good a way as any to make the transition to comments I want to make about science, that theology, like science, is a reflective activity that has overwhelmingly arisen since the invention of literacy in human cultures. And science, I think, is a form of mostly, and certainly in its most formal professional forms of sort of research traditions carried out by communities of scientists, it looks like it's overwhelmingly a reflective activity that's carrying on slowly. It's not to say that individual scientists can't develop expertise and intuitions about scientific matters. They can. Mm-hmm. But if you think even about the form that professional science takes, say, the journal article, it's a very rigorously structured and carefully crafted sort of work. The suggestion, in short, is that popular religion, as opposed to theology, overwhelmingly turns on these maturationally natural capacities and, as it were, engages them. And science, by contrast, does so much less. And indeed, I'd argue that to the extent that science, as it were, has much running time and developed traditions of research, it tends overwhelmingly to end up calling the verdicts of our maturationally natural cognitive systems into question. I mean, science is always generating radically counterintuitive representations of the world, representations that just don't even square with our experience of the world, even after we sort of, oftentimes, even after we've understood the points of these claims. I mean, quantum mechanics is probably the most obvious illustration.
But, certainly agree with that.
You know, in some ways, even the most fundamental of discoveries in the history of science, the scientific revolution, the discovery of, as it were, the Copernican arrangement of the solar system, likewise, is still something that's radically counterintuitive. I mean, among the things that it entails, and that I take it the overwhelming majority of us take to be true, is that right now we're moving 1,000 miles an hour. But no human's perceptual systems ever pick up on that. At one level, all the things on the Earth are moving right along with us. But, I mean, you know, if we look up into the sky, we tend not even to see the sun's motion in these terms. It's very tough, it turns out, to look at the sky as a Copernican. By contrast, the suggestion is that what's going on in religion is, as I said, in the engagement of these maturationally natural systems, typically just very, very minor little violations of some of their deliverances. In this regard, I'm really picking up on ideas that were first laid out by Pascal Boyer in his terrific book, Religion Explained. And actually even an earlier work of his. The suggestion is that religious representations are at least quite modestly counterintuitive, and some folks have even argued minimally counterintuitive. That is to say that, and in fact it looks like in most, say, episodes in any sacred scripture, for example, in any particular narrative, when something's reported, there's only sort of one change, one alteration. In one story, Jesus walks on water. He's still got, we still get all of our sort of default assumptions about Jesus at that point. He's still got a body. He still can see things that are in front of him. He still, if walking on water long enough, will eventually get hungry, and on and on and on. The notion is just that you've got this one violation, in this case, of a physical constraint. Normally, solid human bodies are incapable of walking on water. The suggestion is that this is what makes religious representations particularly appealing to human minds. They're attention-grabbing. After all, somebody's walking on water, that grab your attention.
Pay attention.
Exactly. Again, I won't belabor this, just to say that there is by now an extensive body of experimental research that shows that representations of just this sort, these very modestly counterintuitive representations, are highly memorable. And grabbing attention and being memorable, and then being able to, thirdly, apply all of these default inferences that accompany these sorts of ontological assumptions, these maturationally natural ontological assumptions that humans possess about the world, makes religion and the representations of popular religion extremely attractive to human mind, extremely easy to deal with. And this is a non-trivial consideration when you recall that religion began in our non-literate past. Mm-hmm. Likewise in cultures, though there are very few at this point left on the face of the earth, but likewise in cultures where everyone is not literate, or where literacy, as in a few cases, may not even yet be known. well, how is it that you have any sense of community and continuity and a tradition? And it's got to turn on just these kinds of considerations, these psychological and cognitive considerations I've been pointing to. That's, I suppose you would say, principally engaging our ontological assumptions about the world. But, you know, think of any of the number of other kinds of systems I've talked about. I mean, say, language. I use that as an illustration of a maturationally natural system. How does religion engage it as a maturationally natural system? We're talkative. We're talkative creatures. We talk all the time in all sorts of settings, and you know, likewise in religious settings. But that's not really the point. As I said, these maturationally natural systems are fast. They're unconscious. They're typically automatic, which is to say, if you get the right cue, these systems just take off, and in fact, you can't even control them consciously. And language is like that.
If I could interrupt you for one second,
sure.
If I'm understanding you correctly, it seems like you're arguing that perhaps this popular notion of religion is rather intuitive. And I may have this wrong, but it seems like perhaps we have religion as intuitive, but it's, you know, perhaps based and spread on these minimally counterintuitive concepts. Do we have a language problem here, or am I using...
No, I think you've got it exactly right. Overwhelmingly, the appeal of religion is intuitive. Exactly, it involves agents that are, because of these very small violations of our ontological maturation and natural ontological assumptions, turn out to be attention grabbing, highly memorable, and yet, because of all the default inferences that come with those ontological assumptions, and there's only a violation of one of them, we still know a lot about them. If I know that a god is an agent, I know that that god has preferences, that that god has thoughts and beliefs and desires, and that the god's actions will be parsed accordingly to those considerations, and on and on and on. If I could for just a second return to this point that I was going to make about language. You know, the question is, how does religion engage language as a maturationally natural system? And I would answer in the phenomenon of glossolalia. Glossolalia, more popularly known as speaking in tongues, is not something that is exclusive to the Christian tradition. It's out there in lots and lots of religions. And, you know, what's going on? Well, humans hear utterances, human utterances. And as soon as we start hearing human utterances, our language systems start operating automatically. I mean, in the same sense in which right now you, neither you nor any of your listeners, can hear what I'm saying as mere sound. Even if you try to hear it as mere sound, you're unable to. You'll parse it as language, and it will be, if I'm at least remotely successful, meaningful. Well, what's going on in glossolalia? We're getting sounds that are human voices. They're engaging our language systems. The language systems are inferring this must be language. If you draw that inference, the next inference is it must be meaningful. If you draw that inference, the next inference must be, well, I should probably try to figure out what it means. And, of course, this is a source of mystery and wonderment for, by now, I'm sure, millions and millions of religious people all over the world. So language is an illustration. I mean, there are a variety of others, including, as I've been talking about, these ontological domains, and specifically our sort of folk psychology, the notion that religion is populated with popular religion is populated with all sorts of agents that conform mostly to our intuitive psychology, and yet have these very unique features about them that make them quite appealing. You know, the suggestion is, by contrast, science is not like this at all. It tends to overwhelmingly downplay the role of agent causality. It doesn't look to agents for explanations for the most part, and as the science has marched onward, for especially during the modern era, for the last 400 years, what we see is a progressive narrowing of the domains where appealing to agents as explanations is even considered something legitimate. I mean, in the ancient world, the seas, the winds, the mountains, I mean, everything was animate and everything was an agent and understood that way. But slowly but surely, we've purged agency from our physical explanations with the triumph of Darwinian evolution by natural selection. We have purged agency from our biological explanations.
And you're referring to kind of the HAD system, the hyperactive agent detection system?
Well, no, not right this moment. I'm not.
Okay. Okay.
I'll come back to that in just a second, if I might.
Certainly.
Because, indeed, what I was going to say is in the time in which we live right now, we're literally living during an era of the rise of social and psychological and cognitive science, which is to be beginning to, as it were, even as put in abeyance, to sort of set aside the presumptions that the best explanations are to be achieved by attributing invisible agency even to ourselves. So, in short, the suggestion is that, you know, science is overwhelmingly this reflective, slow activity. It's overwhelmingly also moving in a direction that seems, as it were, to sort of downplay the role of agent explanation in the face of, as opposed to the alternative account of explanation in terms of causal mechanisms. Yeah, jumping back to HAD. Okay, well, HAD, in short, HAD stands for Hypersensitive Agent Detection Device. It's become a bit of the jargon in the field, I'm afraid. But the notion is that in this case, and now I'm switching gears, sort of moving back to just talking about what I'm calling these maturationally natural systems. There's loads of evidence that young children, very young children, are very early on quite sensitive to the presence of agents in their environment and to their ability to distinguish actions from other types of events in their environment. That makes perfect sense from an evolutionary standpoint. You've got to know when you're an infant, even when you're an infant, you need to know what things are agents out there, what things are things that you can appeal to for help. Likewise, understanding that there are certain agents out there that could be dangerous, like predators. The suggestion is that it's better to be, as it were, oversensitive about the detection of agency, because if you make a mistake, it's not got a terrible cost associated with it. You've just, as it were, mistaken that what was in fact the tapping of the tree branches on the window upstairs for an agent. And when you went up and found out that no, it was just the wind blowing the tree and that was tapping that window, as it were, defeated the agent presumption. But I suspect that all of us have had such experiences, perhaps often, especially in our houses late at night when things are quiet and suddenly there are creaks or sounds that we can't make sense of. The human mind seems to leap to the presumption, to the hypothesis that there's an agent involved. If this mental equipment was tuned differently, it could be quite hazardous to us. I mean, after all, making a mistake even once in the other direction, that is to say a false negative, where you've decided, oh no, there's not an agent, when in fact there is one, especially in a world, as it were, red in tooth and claw, you could easily enough end up being that undetected agent's lunch. And so the suggestion is that we do have a penchant for attributing agency and for detecting agency out there in our world, and that's what this concept of HAD, as it's used in the literature, is out to capture. It's not so far-fetched. I mean, I grew up in the North, although I've lived in Atlanta now for 31 years, and I certainly remember cold winter mornings begging and pleading with my car to start in cold Chicago winter mornings. I suspect that I know that I have, I suspect you have, and I suspect all of our listeners have had opportunities to have rather extended conversations at times with their computers, asking it what it thinks, you know, what it needs, what it wants from me right now, what it's trying to do, and so on.
Probably cussing at it as well several times.
Now and then, yeah, under those unhappy settings, that's right. But the suggestion, in short, again, is that we do seem to have a penchant for detecting agency and for attributing agency and for looking to agents as our causal explanations of an awful lot of things that go on in the world. Not everything, by any means, but a lot of things. I personally haven't pushed this view, this particular claim about had, especially hard. I think it's one among many contributing factors that might have a role here. Some of my colleagues have argued that, in effect, this is sort of preparation for developing concepts of invisible agents, where, as it were, you had fires, you think there's an agent in your environment, you go to check things out, and, as it were, you can't defeat that, and yet you can't find the agent. Those are the sorts of circumstances that might lead to the begin to hypothesize things like invisible agents. I should add, by the way, that if any of your listeners were doing this, as you know, on October 15th, literally in today's op-ed page of the New York Times, Tanya Luhrmann discusses these very ideas as they've arisen in the work of two of my colleagues, Pascal Boyer and Justin Barrett, in her piece in the op-ed page today.
One of the things, discussing religion as natural, is religion natural for everyone? And I ask this because I think on two accounts. One, we could easily at least conceive of a group of people or people who've never really identified as being religious, kind of as a thought experiment. And also because some of the data we've been sifting through here and some of our various research projects, some of the qualitative stuff, we have some participants who at a very young age, some of them mentioning around 7 or 8, kind of say they've realized that, you know, they've never felt religious and they didn't really believe. Is religion natural for everyone?
It's a great question, and there's actually a lot to say about it. My answer, in short, is that it almost certainly is not natural for everyone. And so, as you can see, this is yet another sort of qualification on my claim, but I'll show you how it fits. I've suggested a number of systems. I've mentioned language, I haven't actually used the term theory of mind, but when I was talking about these sort of psychological representations of agents, mm-hmm. This is connected with our capacities for theory of mind. Kinship. Humans have every good reason to be quite sensitive to who their kin is in the world, and religions routinely create fictive kin by calling people brothers and sisters, God is our father, and so on. A variety of other maturationally natural systems, I think, are hazard precaution systems, are concerns for contaminants in our environments. Turn out that we're very clear about how to deal with contaminants in our environments, and little kids are very clear about how to deal with contaminants in their environment. They know that they're to be avoided. They know that a single touch is enough to contaminate them. They know that if indeed they are touched, they might be contaminated completely. Mm-hmm. These are general forms that seem to cut across all cultures, and by the time children are 5 years of age, they know this. How does religion engage it? Well, it seems to me that what religions routinely do is engage cue, as it were, this contamination avoidance system to mark off sacred spaces or to designate sacred objects. Okay, one of the systems I've talked about is theory of mind. Is everyone naturally religious? Well, some people, I'm purposely have constructed the notion of naturalness to avoid having to sort of make this strong claim, but there are plenty of people out there who've argued that all of these systems I've been talking about are what are known as cognitive modules. That is to say that they're very dedicated little systems in human minds that are there to solve very specific problems, like contamination avoidance, or like understanding natural language, or recognizing kin, and so on, and also detecting agents in the world. And that, you know, if you think about the language of modularity, I don't know about you, but I think about you know, motherboards and computers, and the fact that, that chips come in, as it were, modules. You can plug chips into the boards, and they can, you know, be unplugged. If these systems are modular, and, you know, that's possible. I'm not denying that. Certainly if they're modular, they're maturationally natural, but if they're maturationally natural, I'm not committed to the view that they are modular. But if a module, as it were, becomes unhooked for whatever reason, perhaps congenitally unhooked, but maybe by injury, who knows. But most specifically, theory of mind, if that module were to be, as it were, unhooked, unconnected for whatever reasons, then given the kind of prominent place that theory of mind and minimally counterintuitive agents or agents with minimally counterintuitive properties play in most popular religion around the world, the suggestion would be that these folks wouldn't understand that very well and wouldn't get it. And so, in fact, as you may know, the final chapter of my book is one that says I've got sort of seven surprising consequences of the comparison I make between religion and science at the cognitive level. And I don't promise that every one of them is going to surprise every mm-hmm. reader, but I'm pretty confident that at least one or two will take most readers by surprise. Maybe not the same one or two, but probably the one that I suspect gets most people's attention most quickly is my suggestion that indeed there are certain kinds of cognitive disabilities, or at least alternative cognitive arrangements, that may well render religion baffling for certain kinds of human minds. The kinds of minds I have most clearly in mind here is the minds of people who are autistic. Mm-hmm. Simon Baron Cohen, in his deservedly renowned book entitled Mind Blindness, argues that autistic people are mind blind. They're mind blind about us, about other humans. There's every reason to expect that they would be comparably mind blind about religious utterances and religious claims about gods and so on. They're no better at detecting, as it were, divine agents than they are we mere mortal agents. And so, you know, the suggestion is not that they, you know, that their families won't take them to religious services or that they won't be involved in rituals. All of that's perfectly possible. And the suggestion, though, crucially also, is not a comment about intelligence, because autistic people as a population show the same distribution of intelligence that the normal population shows. This isn't about things like general intelligence. It's a suggestion that at least one of their maturationally natural systems, namely theory of mind, is in some sense could be described as being impaired. The detection of minds is not something that comes naturally to them. And if that's the case, then my suggestion is that their ability to at least carry out creative inferences about gods and the sorts of divine creatures or counterintuitive creatures counterintuitive agents that populate religious systems is going to be pretty baffling. They're not going to be very clear about it. There are no doubt a host of other variables that have an impact here, and many of them are culturally specific in lots of cases. My claim is not that every human mind will inevitably prove to be religious, but it is a claim about populations of human minds, that religious ideas will inevitably arise in populations of human minds. These are just very natural variations on the kinds of representations that we deploy. And so it's not just religion where they arise. I mean, they're in folk tales, they're in fantasy, they're in fiction. In our more modern world, they're in cartoons and commercials. Comic books, Hollywood, you know, with all of our superhero movies that have taken on such a an appeal and have been such sort of guaranteed blockbusters for Hollywood to make tens and hundreds of millions of dollars. In short, it's not just religion that has become clear about these maturationally natural dispositions of human minds. I think at least advertisers in Hollywood are just as clear about them.
We're about at the end of the program here, and is there anything else that you would like to cover or close on in terms of why religion is natural and science is not?
Well, in short, I suppose, I mean, I've mostly, and understandably, given your provenance, I've mostly been talking about religion. Maybe I could say at least a few more things about science.
Mm-hmm.
I want to begin by stressing, as indeed I did much earlier, that I don't think that everything about science is cognitively unnatural. I think we are natural-born theorizers. Whenever we confront some expectation that is foiled by the world, we start instantly jumping to theories, alternative hypotheses to make sense of that. There's, again, I won't, you know, sort of belabor the details, but I think it's fair to say that this is been one of the landmark discoveries of developmental psychology in the last 30 years or so, and that is that young infants in the first months of life already clearly have a variety of expectations about how the world works. If they're presented with stimuli that foil those expectations, the kids are startled. And they show a number of characteristic behaviors. You know, for example, the length of time at which they'll stare at a stimulus. It looks like it differs significantly when their expectations are overthrown than as opposed to things that conform to their expectations. That said, and I should also add that there's also evidence, again, from even very young children that humans are sensitive to evidence. Those features of science, I think, are cognitively natural. But I want to stress that I don't think that's all that science is. It's neither just, excuse me, the formulating of theories. It's not just a sensitivity to evidence. It's overwhelmingly in that sort of development of evidence, the sort of discerning it, yes, but collecting it, recording evidence, generating new evidence, analyzing evidence that's available to us to ascertain its relevance and its import, and then finally, indeed, assessing evidence. And lots of research in the cognitive science of science indicates that these are tasks that human minds, not just children's minds, but adults' minds, and indeed, adults who even have extensive scientific education, these are tasks that all human minds find extremely difficult to do. I could give a variety of illustrations, from our failures to carry out sound hypothetical inference to our penchant for confirmation bias to a variety of exceedingly fallible heuristics that inform so much of our reasoning, especially famously demonstrated by, again, Daniel Kahneman and his colleague Amos Tversky with regard to probabilistic reasoning.
Mm-hmm.
But also just, I would also argue, intrusive interjections from sort of maturational natural systems. Remember, I said they're automatic, and, you know, even if you get an extensive science education, that doesn't make these maturationally natural deliverances go away. These systems are still in there. They're still firing. They still fire automatically when cued. My favorite illustration of this is research that was carried out at Johns Hopkins University by Mike McCloskey a few decades ago, in which McCloskey looked at students who had taken college-level physics and successfully passed the course, you know, the introductory course, giving them very, very simple little problems in mechanics that given that they had passed the course, should have been trivial for them to solve. And finding that, in fact, about 25% of his subjects, when faced with these kinds of problems, threw all the physics learning that they had had right out the window and right back to their sort of folk physical intuitions and gave incorrect answers. That's what I mean by the intrusion of maturationally natural systems. It's just as true in science as it is in religion and theology. The flip side of this is that theologians formulate highly abstract characterizations of the beliefs and doctrines of their religious systems, and the fact of the matter is, what every religious educator knows is that human minds don't find these kinds of formulations very easy to understand and to work with. People may memorize the doctrines and be able to recite them, but when you give them problems about carrying out creative inferences or memory tasks, it looks like, again, just like some of McCloskey's physics students, all of that learning goes right out the window and people become thoroughly anthropomorphic again and thinking about God. God's like Superman. He's got a lot of really cool powers, but he's still like Superman. He hears people who are closer to him easier than he hears people who are far away from him. It takes him a moment at least to get from one place to another, and then so on. This has been done in a paradigm in which you give people stories and then ask them to recall the stories. And even though the stories are written in a way that are completely consistent with their theologically correct beliefs, that's not how they remember the stories. And it's a pretty whopping effect, and it's an effect, again, that's been demonstrated across cultures and lots of different religious systems.
I'm afraid we're about out of time here. So I would like to thank you, Dr. McCauley, very much for joining us on the program.
My pleasure. It's been great fun, and I really appreciate the opportunity to chat with you and to talk about this project.
Thank you very much.
Talking of RSP promises, did we promise too much with that title, maybe? Why religion is natural and science is not? It's an unusual statement for the Religious Studies Project to make, isn't it, Chris?
It's an unusual statement for us to make, and one where we're sort of happy to go, well, that was Robert and Tommy's decision to call the interview. That wasn't our decision. But also, as I was saying before we started recording it, to make a statement like that is not to say that one thing is right and another is wrong. We had this odd thing in modern society where people tend to see if something is natural, then it's sort of the best, or it's the way things are meant to be in some way.
You might want to see Bruno Latour's recent lectures or Ron Taylor's interviews with us previously to unpack that a little bit.
So, to say that religion is natural, could be interpreted as saying that it's the sort of natural state, the way human beings are meant to be, or that that maybe a more atheistic stance or a more scientistic stance is more cognitively effortful, it's more difficult to maintain. These are questions that it's important to explore. And there's another article by Armin Geertz, who's another interviewee that we've had on it was our second podcast on the cognitive science of religion. It's quite some time ago now, but and it was titled "Why Religion Is Natural and Atheism Is Not." So it was almost making the same argument there. So
it's why breathing is natural, but creating paintings isn't. I mean, that's the way I see it. It need not be a statement which. It's not intended as a normative statement, certainly from our point of view. It's part of our origins series, or our reductionist series, as we called it last week, where we are looking at explanations which suggest a single kind of origin for religion.
There are plenty out there. They've been, I mean, for one of the courses I'm tutoring on at New College, I've just been on David Hume this week, so that's been... It's remarkable, actually, what Hume was writing before Darwin, before there was this notion of evolution. The arguments that Hume puts forward now just map so well onto, you know, sort of early, you know, sort of Tyler and things like that. It sounds very familiar, yet you know that they don't have that common ground in Darwin. So we're possibly going to have a fourth podcast in this Origin series. We've been quite lax at actively pursuing Tommy to make sure that it is actually happening, but we can tell you that next week is their third episode. Do you want to say what it is there, David?
So next week we have an interview with Merlin Donald, recorded by Jacksonis at the AAR last year. It's entitled Ritual, Religion and the Evolutionary Foundations of Human Culture. And basically the idea is that the human culture grows out of ritual, out of the development of ritual and the roles that ritual demarcates within society is part of the process towards the larger, more differentiated societies that we have nowadays. And interestingly, again, as we've been saying, you know, these theories go back to kind of 19th century reductionist ones, and this is very obvious in sort of work of Fraser, for instance, where you have this progression through magic to religion to modernity to science, if you like. And this is kind of the same idea, that the religious specialists of yesteryear become the social functionaries of the modern age.
Yep.
So again, we see, much as we did with Stuart Guthrie's interview, we see a kind of updating of these kind of 19th century early anthropological theories in a more modern context. So, yeah, hopefully we know it's controversial. We're hoping that people will complain on the site, get involved in the comments on the site.
Please do.
Where else can they get involved, Chris?
You can get involved on Facebook, on Twitter, on Google+. You can even leave us ratings and comments on iTunes.
And you can send incendiary missives, if you wish, to editors@religiousstudiesproject.com.
Can indeed. On the topic of editors, David and I have just been wading through the masses of applications to be our new assistant editor. So we've made a few decisions, but no one's been informed.
We can't tell you yet because we haven't spoken to the people, but we have made decisions.
And some exciting news, I think, to come, but we'll hold off until we...
Yeah, hopefully next time we meet you we'll be able to announce our new editor. We'll finally be at full speed with our editorial team. It's exciting times. But this is all next week.
This is all next week. For now, as ever, we'll sign off with the immortal words.
Thanks for listening.